Hello and welcome to the Global Insight podcast with me, Claudine Fry, a partner at Control Risks. We are going to talk seabed mining today, and I'm delighted to be joined by two of my brilliant team for the discussion. Gabriel Brazil, sitting with me here in London, a senior analyst and our global lead on energy transition and critical minerals. Welcome to the podcast, Gabriel.
Thank you, Claudine. A pleasure to be here.
And we are also joined by Dr. Victoria Mitchell, who is in Amsterdam, is an analyst and a leading expert on maritime issues. Welcome, Victoria.
Hi, Claudine. Thank you for having me.
In an earlier edition of this podcast, our colleague Steve Norris called out controversies and opportunities relating to seabed mining as a hot topic to watch. We are recording this follow-up to focus specifically in on those issues, and it seems timely. Activity to explore the potential impact of seabed mining is stepping up, in some national jurisdictions at least, as Victoria will unpack for us a bit later in the discussion. Also, activities by environmentalists to campaign against seabed mining are stepping up, and governments are taking very different positions on it. One thing is clear, and that's that demand for the minerals we may be extracting from the sea will continue to grow and grow. Gabriel, let's start there, actually, just to scene set a bit with some comment from you about the outlook for demand for critical minerals, and perhaps you can briefly outline for us what it is that is actually under the sea. And given that there's been some tapering off of the hype and value associated with critical minerals recently, talk us through what sort of minerals we might need that are under the sea, and why is there an intensifying focus on getting them out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just first on the hype and the QM trends, I think in the short term, we've seen some volatility and some reducing prices for some of the minerals, which has triggered some people to think that maybe this is not really a resilient trend, that of the growing demand for critical minerals. And I think we should put that into perspective. So in the short term, the investment environment globally is very fragile, due to a combination of factors that are really short-term oriented, at least from where we see them at this point. So higher for longer interest rates, which are really annoying for more complex projects. Obviously, the conflicts in Gaza and in Ukraine, which continue to be disruptive to some markets. The U.S. elections, which there's so much uncertainty there that some investors are adopting a wait-and-see approach. But if we look at the long term and what we can expect for the coming decade, for example, I think the energy transition continues to be the most significant investment opportunity for companies and countries globally. I know there are some other growing trends out there. I think AI probably being the hottest one. But the energy transition has already mobilized dozens or hundreds of billions of dollars, and policymakers, strategic decisions by multiple companies. So I think this is very much a resilient trend from an investment perspective. And then finally, to your question, I think it leads us to the point, which is this comes against a backdrop of growing geopolitical competition. We have US and China as the two main global powers fighting for influence over a number of areas such as defense, technology, ideology, the economy, and so on. And that will bring, in addition to geopolitical fragmentation, also risks to the access of resources. So some people might say that we have enough minerals to power the energy transition already out there. But there's a difference between them being enough and them being accessible for those groups of countries. And that's where seabed mining comes in. And I think Victoria will be able to tell us more about how that's playing out and how that has now become this new frontier for geopolitical competition.
Thanks, Gabriel. So, Victoria, can you give me... The basics here. When we talk about seabed mining, what are we actually talking about, and to what extent has there been any seabed mining to date?
Okay, thanks, Claudine. Yeah, so as a sort of 101 on seabed mining, it's mining for specific deposit types on the seabed. And for the seabed, you can kind of split this into three. So in terms of what you could mine for, there are cobalt-rich crusts, there are hydrothermal vents, and these vents have sulfur-rich minerals, which then harden into minerals like copper and zinc. And you have polymetallic nodules. And the one that's being talked about a lot, and this is because of the technological capacity to mine them, is polymetallic nodules. I know previously, Claudine, and we talk a lot about supply chains and avocados, so I thought today I'd come to the podcast and change it up and we can talk potatoes. So, because it's very hard to understand the seabed, and we're talking thousands of meters down here. So trying to visualize what we're trying to mine for is best if I tell you that a polymetallic nodule is a potato-shaped rock, and it's on the seabed. It takes a long, long, long time to form, and it contains cobalt, nickel, copper, manganese, some of among the critical minerals that previous podcast in which Gabrielle, I'm sure we're talking about needed for the energy transition. And that kind of leads me on to why this matters. And it matters for, as Gabrielle's highlighted, around reasons of security of supply. Although there's a position that there's sufficient available elsewhere, there is so much on the seafloor that is what's driving this interest as people try to secure their supply for the energy transition. So to take one statistic, if we just look at the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is in the Pacific Ocean, so international area, that is roughly understood as 1.3% of the ocean floor. And it's understood also to contain more nickel, cobalt, and manganese than all on land deposits. So if we decide to mine, that just demonstrates how much would be available. But with that in view and the concerns about geopolitics and security of supply, I think then we have to ask, well, why are we not rushing headlong into the space, right? And that brings me to your point about like where we're at and the unknowns, really. And as you referenced at the top, Claudine, there is a shift in the national space. In particular, back in January, I believe, Norway started discussing about opening up waters for assessment and exploration. But in the international waters, which is around about 50% of the ocean floor, there's still a lack of regulation that would enable people to go in and explore and exploit these seabed resources. And that's where we start seeing the key space to watch. Because while an individual state can make a decision to open up areas of their waters for this effort, one of my all-time favorite Law of the Sea terms is common heritage of mankind. And that is something applied to this space, this international deep seabed area. And it's to be utilized for the benefit of mankind, humankind as a whole. So we need international agreement on how this is managed, and we're not there yet. The rules, regulations, and procedures to allow for exploration are not there. And this brings us right back around to the kind of geopolitical wrinkles that we're here to discuss today. One of the headlines that I'd probably highlight is that the USA has not ratified the convention, and so it doesn't form a part of this body, the International Seabed Authority, that's setting up these rules, regulations, and procedures, and yet is a major player in conversations about security of supply of critical minerals to support and to ensure its energy transition.
Thanks, Victoria. That's absolutely fascinating. We need to unpack the geopolitics. We need to unpack a bit more of that regulatory picture that you started painting for us there, Victoria. So I just want to, first of all, get clear around what's at stake here. So it's clear from what you've both said that seabed mining could be a way of tapping into a richness of resources and therefore help us to be much more confident about our ability to tap into the minerals that we need to achieve energy transition. But Gabrielle, you also made a really interesting point earlier about the accessibility angle to the search to secure sufficient amounts of critical minerals. Victoria, that potato that you described for us down there at the very bottom of the sea, a very, very long way away from where we're sitting right now, is presumably not that easy to access.
Well, indeed. And it is also finite, which firstly raises one of the challenges around uncertainties, because whilst there are technological capacity to do something, essentially you have a robot launch from a ship which will descend to the seafloor and then acts almost as a vacuum cleaner to vacuum up these nodules along the seabed. It's not widely tested. It's very controversial, and that's why we're seeing that it's coming into the geopolitical space, both at the state level, where we're seeing governments take very clear positions on either side, whether to support a moratorium or that would like to push forward with exploration. And importantly, also from a wider public position, we're seeing businesses and environmental groups holding very clear positions on where they think we should be standing and going with respect to seabed mining.
Thanks, Victoria. So we know there's an awful lot of potatoes or nodules of critical minerals down there at the bottom of the sea, and we know how to get them out, but we don't really understand yet what the implications of getting them out might be.
Absolutely.
Okay. So turning to the geopolitics now, you mentioned, Victoria, that we've had countries taking different positions. The UK is one of a number. I think it's a couple of dozen. Is it, Victoria, who have issued a moratorium on doing anything until we understand better what the environmental implications of doing so would be? We've had Norway, on the other hand, indicating that it is going to press ahead with seabed mining. Gabriel, give us a sense of how the geopolitical environment is playing into the way countries are positioning themselves on minerals and critical minerals and seabed mining specifically as well.
Yeah, of course. I think when we discuss critical minerals trends, there are two main drivers. One we have just addressed, many people have addressed, which is the economic driver. Basically, there will be growing demand, and that demand comes on the back of the climate crisis and the need for decarbonization and so on. But then there's another driver, which is the political one, that comes on the back of what we just discussed as well on the growing U.S.-China competition. And by U.S.-China, I don't only mean U.S. and China. I mean the growing blocks of countries and everything in between. Given the geopolitical fragility we have right now, no one wants to depend too much on a few suppliers. So the I guess the key word for geopolitics right now is resilience. And for this topic specifically, we're talking about supply chain resilience. We know that China is a dominant player in both extraction and production of critical minerals for many of them. And obviously the US and its allies, they don't want to rely on that too much. So everyone is doing something to improve their hands with regards to self-sufficiency and, you know, how able they will be to develop the energy transition strategies in the coming years. There are a few trends that are worth highlighting. I think the main one is the creation by this Western bloc led by the US of the Mineral Security Partnership, the MSP. It's basically a group of 14 or 16 countries. Every day they invite someone new, which include Australia, Canada, obviously the European Union, Japan, and so on, which is really a strategy by the US and these countries to work as a bloc against China, given how powerful China is in this space. There are also, in parallel, some bilateral initiatives, for example, between the U.S. and Japan, the U.S. and Philippines, and initiatives that complement each other, all in the sense of securing supply chain resilience. China, on the other hand, obviously, is also implementing its own strategies, generally with the Belt and Road countries. It's been engaging with Argentina, the DRC, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, and multiple producing countries to make sure that, one, they can sustain the dominance they already have, but also benefit from the verticalization capacity they have. So BYD, this major automaker from China, just bought some assets in the lithium industry in Brazil. And they also installed a new production facilities there, which just showcases a bit of the Chinese approach. You know, we're going to verticalize the supply chain and make sure that we remain dominant across different aspects of production and development. So long answer to a short question, countries are active. Critical minerals is a battlefield for geopolitical competition. And I think this will only intensify in the coming years as demand for solar panels, batteries, wind turbines, and so on increase.
What does that competition mean for businesses across value chains, Gabriel?
That's a good one. And that's a space we've been helping our clients a lot in recent months. I think one assumption to have in mind is that competition means more, not less costs, contrarily to what it normally means in an economic perspective. It means more costs because countries will be implementing trade controls, sanctions, regulatory barriers. They will use existing regulations such as around ESG to make sure that the adversaries are not able to trade whatever they are trading as freely as they could. And obviously, businesses might be caught in the middle. They want to, buy cobalt and lithium and whatever they need to produce what they produce, and they might have troubles sourcing and assessing such materials. They might face sanctions. So it is a minefield of regulatory integrity, ESG risks that companies will have to navigate as this geopolitical competition trend advances in the coming years.
Awareness of political, country, and economic risks underpin your organization's ability to protect value and mitigate shocks. Whether you need consulting on a particular project or longer-term strategic, analytical, and forecasting resources, we can respond to your requirements face-to-face or through our online platform-based solutions. For more information, follow the link in the podcast notes.
Victoria, I'm interested in understanding a bit more about how that regulatory framework might evolve. How will it work if there is an international agreement, but it's around how regulation of seabed mining should evolve, but the organization that formulates the framework doesn't include the US? How will that play out? And then also, will those rules apply in national waters as well as international waters?
To take your last question first, probably because it's the easiest one, there will be a distinction. So the national and the international would remain separate. How it's playing out? Well, the International Seabed Authority is making progress. It meets, often it has an annual meeting where it pushes forward with efforts to create the rules, regulations, procedures needed. These would place reporting and environmental obligations on any companies who were going to begin to explore in the international space. So we do expect to see progress. We do expect to see progress, not least because a quirk in the system, if you will, was a couple of years ago where the state of Nauru triggered a two-year rule, which meant that at the end of a two-year period, the regulation should be in place to allow mining to take place, and this didn't occur. So now there's a potential disconnect between the type of mining which can happen and the absence of rules, regulations, and procedures. No company has said that they want to begin in advance of regulations and procedures being in place. But we do see pressure to get everything agreed and to have a clear position on operating in this space. And I think that is going to continue and increase for the same reasons that Gabrielle's mentioned about the need for security of supply, demand, people will want to have a clear stance and position on this. How is it playing out geopolitically? Well, the US is a fascinating example. There's been reports in the media of former political and military leaders in the US calling for the US to ratify the Convention on the Law of the Sea, which would then enable it to have a space, a place, and a voice in these discussions. Because whilst the power of the US means that it has power in bilateral conversations and so on and so forth, so it's not voiceless, it's certainly not got a seat at this table. And that's been something which has been going on for a long period, but really drives home the critical nature of this issue, because it is forcing people to discuss the US becoming a convention which it has for decades not done.
Let's turn our attention now to the commercial angle, or the business angle, if you like. Steve Norris talked a lot about the sort of the first mover advantage and the sense of hunger that there is. I think probably in some governments, and as you say, Victoria, that's driving a degree of urgency around getting something formulated from a regulatory perspective. But there's clearly also hunger. In the business world, there is a huge amount of opportunity here on seabed mining, whether it's for companies who might be extracting, processing, or using the critical minerals. Gabriel, you mentioned the trend around establishing vertical supply chains in automotives and in other sectors as well. So there's a lot of companies who maybe haven't been involved in seabed activity or in mining before, who are considering entering, and some of the established players in both of those worlds are clearly also positioning themselves to take advantage of any opportunities that might be arising. But what do businesses need to be thinking about and watching for when they contemplate how the expansion or start of seabed mining might create opportunities and challenges for them?
Yeah, I think from a geopolitical perspective, and we are obviously biased here, but there is this growing consensus that geopolitical risk is a strategic risk. And this is something that the companies that are ahead are already accommodating in today's strategies. And that's a trend that I think will persist. More than ever, being resilient politically wise will be a competitive advantage. If we look back in a couple of years at the disruptive events such as conflict related, obviously the pandemic as well, how that impacted businesses' resiliency, I think that's a lesson for companies on how they need to be prepared in terms of risk management. There are some challenges there. First is that risk management practices, as we have been discussing recently, they are overloaded. That are a number of simultaneous crises, the climate crisis, uncertain elections, civil unrest in certain countries, and so on. So companies need to prioritize and be really assertive in mitigating such crises. That will require spinning multiple plates simultaneously and retaining competitiveness. Obviously, the financial environment doesn't help with higher interest rates. Some of these initiatives that they need to implement to secure resilience require investments, and that's something that companies will need to accommodate. Before I hand over to Victoria, just one assumption that I think businesses or business leaders should have in mind is that critical minerals risks are not only about mining and energy. They're really going to be spread across the economy. Think of everything that needs a battery, tech companies, healthcare, the EV sector, and so on. So the spillover effects might be more significant than many people think.
Right. This isn't just a conversation for mining companies.
Absolutely not.
Victoria, I know that there was a report just issued by the Worldwide Fund for Nature, which included some information for financial institutions to bear in mind about seabed mining. Can you give us a bit of a sense of what our listeners should know about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, the Worldwide Fund for Nature is a recognised environmental organisation, and they have come out with a report with recommendations for financial institutions talking about their position on seabed mining and why it poses specifically in their language an unacceptable risk. But what they're also doing in that report is highlighting the types of players that might be involved in the space. As you've just been talking about, it's not just mining company talking to mining company. It will be mining companies. It will be investors. It will be people who are supplying, say, a vessel or technological equipment. And they'll be the people who then want to utilize the critical minerals, but will need to be aware of where they have come from. The position of, in the report is to highlight that the risk is unacceptable, and also that financial institutions should do specific due diligence on what they are potentially investing in, providing funding for. And they really highlight certain companies, financial institutions' positions on this issue. And I think that's a really critical thing that businesses in general need to be thinking about, because we have, on the one hand, geopolitics and thinking about where you're trying to operate, but you're also in a market, and it could be that you are trying to provide services, or you are trying to sell to people whose positions may be different on the subject of this subject of critical minerals and the subject of seabed mining. So it really is a great example of highlighting the need to be aware and to ensure that you are aware of your entire market and your supply chain.
Yeah, we've seen clearly already quite a bit of activity by environmental groups campaigning against seabed mining. And as you say, Victoria, there is going to be scrutiny around what positions companies are taking on seabed mining, how public that positioning is, and it's going to attract attention. Victoria, you've been monitoring and advising clients on direct action as it manifests offshore for years. Can you explain for us how direct action by groups such as Greenpeace is evolving, and how you expect campaigns relating to seabed mining to translate into direct action offshore?
Yeah, absolutely. And indeed, there are already cases in point where we've seen groups, specifically Greenpeace, because they are the group with the capacity, they have vessels capable of transiting deep offshore. So as well as capacity to operate deep offshore, which is within the remit of groups with ocean-going vessels like Greenpeace, you can target such operations in ports closer offshore while a vessel is under tow, for example. And that's been done by different groups raising the same concerns. That's something that were we to see seabed mining increase, we would likely see a corresponding increase in a response, and a very public response to this type of activity, because of the proliferation of groups that have environmental concerns and the very clear controversies surrounding this pioneering activity.
Thank you, Victoria. And I can imagine that we will expect to see some of those actions carried out offshore being coordinated with onshore activity as well. We work with a lot of companies to help them understand what might be targeted at their headquarters, for example. Something to watch very closely in the months ahead, I think. Mm. So we're going to wrap the discussion up now, and I'm going to put you both on the spot a little bit. Right. Victoria, I'm going to put you ask you to think up and out into the future and not down under the sea, as you are normally focusing your thoughts. Do you imagine that in a few years' time, we will have reached an international consensus on seabed mining, and therefore that the moratoriums and calls for bans that we have in place at the moment will have been lifted at a certain point?
I mean, it's instinctively I don't know. And that is because it is an incredibly long-running geopolitical process with almost, over 100, I think it's 167 states in the International Seabed Authority, also the European Union. There's a lot of opinions. There's very clear positions being taken on a moratorium by some states, like the UK, Latin France. But I think what we're likely to see is over time some coalescence and Whilst I don't know what would need to be in place for a call for a moratorium to be reversed, in the C space, eventually in the past, we have seen a coalescence around a position. So that is not impossible. But at this point in time, I don't see that we are proceeding in a direction that would cause states to reverse or change course on a stated position, not least because they have taken that with very careful consideration of their various constituencies, including civil society groups.
Thank you, Victoria. Yet another area of immense inconsistency and complexity characterizing the geopolitical environment at the moment. Gabriel, I'm going to turn to you now and ask if you think that seabed mining is going to be a source of conflict in the future.
To stay on theme, I'm going to say that these are uncharted and troubled waters. So risk management very often is about identifying trends and then making sense of them, trying to see how they can become threats and from threats to risk. And the trend that we have right now is clearly a trend of instability and fragility. And around that, we have other issues that are also adding complexity to that. So the climate crisis, economic uncertainty, and then some more specific issues as well. For example, if we take AI, which is the big buzzword of the moment, how much electricity will that require in the coming years and what impacts that will have on critical minerals demand? So we just don't know. But I guess what we can say is that pressure is rising up. And it's better to be on the safe side and to, you know, do your risk assessments, your scenario-based plans and so on, because risks are increasing, that's for sure.
Nice segue to my final question, Gabriel. You just mentioned some of the very specific and tangible things that clients should be doing at the moment to position themselves and be ready for what lies ahead if they're going to be linked in any way to seabed mining. Can you say a bit more on that, Gabriel? What do you think businesses should be doing? Yep.
Of course, I think the main assumption that they should be embracing, and many of our clients are, is what I said about treating geopolitical risk as a strategic risk because of how disruptive it can be. So that's number one. And if we treat it from a strategic perspective, you can engage with stakeholders that will be able to implement tools and policies and mechanisms to future-proof operations and investments. And in more concrete terms, this means scenario-based risk assessments, regulatory monitoring, sanctions monitoring. Yes, you do diligences. Yes, you risk monitoring. And bespoke exercises tailored to each company's a specific exposure to suppliers, to jurisdictions, to regulation, and so on.
Victoria, if I put the same question to you, it's interesting. It occurs to me that you might be working with a very different type of client over the coming years that isn't used to dealing with offshore issues. I wonder what you imagine they might need from your expertise and your team as they're considering and maybe venturing into seabed mining.
I think for such a client, if they were using seabed mining as their day one of introduction to offshore, I think there would be the first and foremost the operational considerations, understanding firstly how a seabed mining operation might work, but also offshore considerations generally, understanding the different people in a market that they would now be interacting with. For example, you will need to use a port, you would need to use crewing agencies, you'd need to talk to a variety of stakeholders that you may not be otherwise working with. And then I think more broadly, for whichever businesses start working into this space, the main things are those really that Gabrielle's mentioned, that you need to have a very holistic view of what you are stepping into, because as we've been highlighting repeatedly throughout, this is a pioneering space. It's a lot of unknowns. And as Steve Norris talked about in the previous podcast, there is a potential for first mover advantage, but that comes if you've built in your knowledge and your preparedness to make that move and to take that advantage.
Thank you both. It's been fascinating talking to you about seabed mining. Victoria from Amsterdam, do please join us again soon. It's been brilliant having you on.
Thank you so much for having me, Claudine.
Gabriel, super to have you on the podcast again. And I do hope you will join me again for another edition very soon. But for now, thank you.
Thank you, Claudine. Thank you, Victoria. It's been a pleasure.
If you liked what you heard on this episode of The Global Insight, make sure to subscribe. And don't forget to check out our other podcasts as well, like Decrypt, featuring our experts from across the world making sense of the cyber and technology issues impacting business. As always, thanks for listening.